From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Candle. I'm indebted to Mrs. Graham, who heard me give a talk on ghostly phenomena at a club in London one evening in the 20s of the present century, for the following story. When I was a girl, she said, some friends of ours named Halkett lived in a house in Warwickshire. On account of the rumors that it was haunted, Lady Halkett experienced great difficulty in obtaining servants. From the appearance of the house, one might have imagined that there was truth in the rumors. It certainly looked haunted. It was a large, low, rambling, picturesque old gray stone building nestling between stately elm trees. A massive front door opened into a great hall, in the center of which was a broad oak staircase leading to a gallery that connected the two wings of the building. There were family portraits and ancient weapons on the walls of the hall, and armor and old china in every available corner. No matter how fine and sunny the day, the house was cold and gloomy. I often wondered how Lady Halkett could live there and always seem to be so bright and happy. She told me that nothing would induce her to leave the house that had harbored so many generations of her family and in which she had spent some of the happiest moments of her life. She loved company and was seldom without visitors. I can only remember her as a widow, her husband, an officer in a Highland regiment, having died in India before I was born. She had two daughters, Alice and Margaret, tall, good-looking girls, older than I. We were great friends, and they constantly invited me to their home, in the summer to croquet and lawn tennis, in the winter to balls and indoor games. Lady Halkett was very fond of cards, and she and my mother used frequently to play bezique and cribbage, while the girls and I indulged in something rather more frivolous. On these occasions, the carriage always came for us at 10 o'clock. When there was a ball, Lady Halkett very kindly put us up for the night. I shall never forget the last time I went to a dance at the house. My mother, who had not been very well for some weeks, was unable to go to the dance, and my Aunt Nora, who was staying with us, accompanied me. It was snowing when we set out, and as it snowed all through the night and most of the next day, the roads were completely blocked, and we were forced to stay with the Halketts until the snow was cleared away. My aunt and I did not share a room. She slept in the east wing of the house where all the other visitors, some of whom were belated like ourselves, slept, and as there was no room for me in that wing, I was given a room in the west wing. My room was the only occupied one in the wing. Nothing at all disturbing happened until the night before we returned home. Margaret and I were ascending the hall stairway to bed when Alice met us looking extremely agitated. "Do come to my room," she said. "Something has happened to Mary." Mary was one of the housemaids. Wondering what on earth was the matter, we accompanied Alice to her room, and on entering it, found Mary seated on a chair, sobbing hysterically. One had only to glance at the girl to see that she was suffering from a very severe shock. Though normally a very rosy, stolid, healthy girl, she was now without a vestige of color. The pupils of her eyes were dilated with terror, and her whole body, from the crown of her head to the soles of her feet, shook as if with ague. "Why, Mary," Margaret exclaimed, "whatever is the matter? What has happened?" "It's the candle in Miss Trevor's room, miss," the girl gasped. "I can't put it out." "You can't put it out? Why, what nonsense," Margaret exclaimed. "Are you mad?" "It's as true as I sit here, miss," Mary panted. "I put the candle on the mantelpiece while I set the room to rights, and when I had finished and tried to blow it out, I wasn't able to. I blew and blew and blew till I was exhausted, and then I became scared, miss, horribly scared," and she buried her face in her hands and shuddered. "I've never been frightened like this before, miss, and I've come away and left the candle burning." "How absurd of you," Margaret scolded. "We must go and put it out at once. I've a good mind to make you come with us, Mary. For goodness sake, stop crying or everyone in the house will hear you. Margaret, Alice, and I went to Miss Trevor's room, and through the open doorway we saw a lighted candle on the mantel shelf, just as Mary had described. Before we had time to cross the threshold of the room, the door closed with a bang, and there was no perceptible draught. We all in turn tried to open the door and failed. We could not move it. We rested for a few moments and then tried again. I was pushing with all my might when the door flew open and I fell inside the room. The door closed immediately and I was alone in the room. Alice and Margaret tried in vain to open the door and kept banging on it and imploring me to tell them what was happening. I was too shaken and tongue-tied to reply. Though I saw nothing but the candle, the light of which I thought was peculiarly white and vibrating, I felt something menacing and horrible was in the room. It was in the atmosphere, the walls and the furniture. It surrounded me on all sides, an intangible, invisible, evil something that intended to overwhelm and crush me. I thought it emanated from the candle, and I felt that if I could only succeed in extinguishing the light, I should rid the room of it. I got up from the floor, walked to the candle, and blew. Again and again I blew. The candle still burned with the same peculiar white light. I felt that it was mocking me. I panicked and ran to a far corner of the room, anywhere to get away from the candle. I felt it coming stealthily after me, drawing closer and closer. Then there was a blank. I was conscious of nothing until I found myself in Margaret's room, with a half a dozen people gathered around me. Alice told me that when she and Margaret succeeded in opening the door of Miss Trevor's room, they found me looking very dazed, lying on the floor. The candle was still alight on the mantel shelf. Lady Holkett experienced no difficulty in blowing it out. She would not hear of me staying alone any longer in the west wing, and a room was found for me in the east wing of the house. The following morning, my aunt and I returned home. We found my mother in a very critical condition. She died that evening. There are various superstitions in Scotland regarding candles, and I've often wondered if my curious experience with a candle in the Holkett's house was a portent of my mother's death. It occurred just about the time that she was taken so seriously ill. This concluded Mrs. Graham's story. I have compiled it from the notes which I took at the time that it was told me. Mrs. Graham's sister told me that she took a house in Manchester which had a very unlucky staircase. People from no apparent cause were constantly falling down the staircase. The climax came after the death of an aged lady who had been staying there. The undertaker's men who came for the coffin on the day of the old lady's funeral were warned about the staircase, but in spite of their caution, they stumbled in some mysterious manner and fell when they were descending the staircase with the coffin. Fortunately, they were not seriously injured, but the accident was of such a distressing nature that Mrs. Graham's sister, fearful lest anything more alarming might happen, vacated the house long before the termination of the lease. She subsequently learned that no one ever stayed in the house for very long. The Phantom Ape of Hampstead. Mrs. James, a reader of my books, told me when I was living in London an extraordinary story of Mr. Ward, one of her girlhood friends, who was haunted by a phantom ape. Mr. Ward was on a hunting and exploring expedition in a jungle in Sumatra. One day he accidentally shot a pig-tailed macaque. It belonged to a Batak woman who was reputed to be a sorceress. She cursed him and said that he would always be haunted by something far more terrifying than anything in this world. He tried to appease her, but without avail. She spat at him when he offered her money and threatened to kill him if he did not leave the neighborhood at once. Soon after his encounter with her, he was mauled by a wounded tiger. He had hardly recovered from his injuries when he incurred blood poisoning from the bite or sting of a venomous insect. He was so ill that he had to leave Sumatra and return to London. He had not been many days in his flat in Hampstead when he told one of his friends that he was haunted by a phantom ape that came to his bedroom every night and made hideous faces at him. His friend thought that he must be paranoid and advised him to see a doctor. This he would not do. At his earnest request, his friend and a Roman Catholic priest stayed one night in his flat. They kept watch in the dark outside his room after he had gone to bed. Between 1 and 2 o'clock, Ward screamed. They sprang from their chairs and rushed into his room. The priest crossed himself and uttered a prayer. Ward was unconscious. "You believe me now, don't you?" he said, when he had recovered sufficiently to speak. "I do," his friend replied, "although I saw nothing. Father David would not have been so startled and have prayed like he did unless something very terrible was in the room." "Something very terrible was in the room," Father David said. He was ghastly pale and trembling. "I saw it very distinctly. It was Simeon, just like you described it, Mr. Ward, and very diabolical. It vanished directly I prayed. It won't trouble you again." He knelt down and prayed and sprinkled the floor with the holy water, which he had brought with him. He proved to be a good prophet. The Batak woman's curse was no longer effective. The phantom ape never again molested Ward. A Cardiff haunting. Before the First World War, Mr. Moore, who was visiting friends of mine in Upper Norwood, where I was then living, told me several strange stories of ghostly happenings in Wales. One of his stories was about a house in Cardiff. He was invited to spend Christmas in the house, which was then occupied by a family named Webb. The house was old and had stood empty for a considerable time when the Webbs took it. They had heard rumors that it was haunted, but as they did not believe in the supernatural, they ridiculed the idea. Nothing occurred to justify the rumors until Mr. Moore visited them. They were all sitting in the drawing room one evening when there was a rap, as if with knuckles, on the door. Wondering who it could be, as the cook and the two maids were out, Mona Webb, the eldest daughter, got out of her chair before the fire and opened the door. The hall was lighted with gas. As she glanced around the hall, she heard steps ascending the staircase leading from the first landing to the floors above. She at once ran upstairs and searched all the rooms, but found no one. A few days later, Mr. Moore went to his bedroom after luncheon to enjoy a quiet read and smoke. He lit the gas fire, placed an armchair in front of it, and sat down. The chair was already occupied. He sprang up instantly and looked in terror at the chair. No visible being was in it. Summoning up courage, he sat down again, to experience the same sensation of sitting on someone or something that was already in the chair. He decided to read and smoke in the company of beings whom he knew and could see, so he joined Mr. Webb and Arthur, the youngest son, in the dining room. Robert, the eldest boy, was at Sandhurst. Mrs. Webb was the next member of the household to experience the haunting. She was alone one afternoon in the house when she fancied that she heard someone in the hall. She ran to the door of the drawing room where she had been sitting and peered out. She was just in time to see a bony, hairy leg disappear round the bend in the staircase. She was so terrified that she quickly drew back and remained locked in the drawing room until Mr. Webb and Arthur came home. They searched the house but could find no one. Not a word was said to the servants who came in later, lest they should be scared and give notice to leave. On another occasion, Mr. Moore and the Webbs were sitting in the drawing room after dinner when they heard a succession of bumps overhead. Lorna, the second eldest daughter, went to the door and beckoned to the others. They all came to the open door and listened. Presently, something appeared round the bend of the staircase. It was too shadowy for them to see it distinctly, but they got the impression that it was something very extraordinary, not unlike a nude trussed body that did not seem human nor quite animal, but an unpleasant mixture of both and something else. It came bumping down the stairs and rolled right past them to the door at the top of the basement steps. They heard it bumping down the steps. Then there was silence. The Webbs looked at one another aghast. They had all seen and heard the thing, had been too frightened and horribly fascinated to move or utter a word. They returned to the fire, sat huddled and glanced every now and then apprehensively at the door. That same night, Mr. Moore awoke with the feeling he was not alone in the room. He listened and heard a curious pattering sound. It seemed to come from a large cupboard inlet in a corner of the room and to approach the bed. He opened his eyes, looked, and froze. Leaning over the footrail of the bed, grinning at him, was a nude, revoltingly fat, shapeless figure. Its face was yellow, its eyes pale, slanting, and perfectly mad. It did not appear to have a nose. A gruesome light surrounded it. Mr. Moore, forcing himself to keep calm with a great mental effort, bade the thing gone, and in a few moments it faded away and vanished. At the suggestion of a friend who was a spiritualist, the Webbs had a seance one evening. They sat round a table in the breakfast room. For some time nothing happened, and then the table rose and fell and behaved in such a violent manner that Mrs. Webb was frightened and declared that there was something under the table moving it. Several of the other sitters experienced the same feeling, and the seance ended in a panic. The following night, Mona Webb woke feeling very thirsty. She stretched out her hand for the box of matches, which was on a chair by the side of the bed, and touched something cold and clammy. It was a face, not of the living, but the dead. In response to her scream, several of the family ran to her room. They only saw Mona, who had sustained such a severe shock that it was some time before she could explain what had happened. Mr. Moore left the house the following morning, and the Webbs within a fortnight. Strange to say, the servants did not experience any of the ghostly happenings. They could not understand why the Webbs decided to vacate the house so suddenly. A Newcastle haunting. After a lecture that I gave in Manchester before the Second World War, the following story of a North Country haunting was told me by Mr. James McKay. Mr. McKay, who was in business in Newcastle, found the house in which he and his family were living rather too far from his office. There were no automobiles in those days, so he went to view a house near his office. As he was going upstairs to the first floor, he heard footsteps following him. He turned sharply round, but did not see anyone. Thinking this was odd, but supposing that it might be due to the acoustic peculiarities of the building, he continued his descent. He reached the first floor and went into one of the rooms. The footsteps followed him. He stamped his foot. There was no echo. He went into another room. The footsteps still followed him. He became frightened. It was daylight. The day was fine and warm. The sun's rays were streaming in through the blindless windows. He could hear birds singing merrily. In broad daylight, with the sounds of street traffic in his ears, it was absurd to be afraid of ghosts. Ghosts belonged to the night. Whoever heard of them manifesting or demonstrating in the daytime when it was light? Ridiculous. Absolutely silly of him to be scared. And yet he was scared. Something drew his attention to one of the walls. There was a shadow on it, and it was not his shadow. It was not the shadow of anything he had ever seen. He ran down the stairs and out of the house. One would have thought that after that, Mr. McKay would not have thought of renting the house. But the house had a peculiar attraction for him. He was fascinated by it. He could not get it out of his mind. He dreamed about it in connection with the mystery which he tried to solve and was always on the verge of solving when he awoke. There was not another house in the city which was so conveniently situated for him and obtainable at such a low rent. Consequently, he took the house and within a few days had moved into it with all his family and household goods. For the first few weeks, nothing at all disturbing occurred, and Mr. McKay plumed himself upon having made such an excellent bargain. He had got the house at an even lower rental than it was offered at first. One morning, however, something occurred that made him feel not quite so thoroughly pleased with himself. He was writing a letter in his study when the nursemaid came to him in a state of great agitation. "Oh, please, come at once to the nursery, sir," she implored. "The children are playing with something that looks like a dog, and it's not a dog. I don't know what it is," and she began to cry. "You're mad," Mr. McKay exclaimed impatiently. He nevertheless sprang up from his chair and ran upstairs. On reaching the nursery, the blurred outline of something like a big dog or wolf came out of the half-open door and tore past him, so close that he distinctly felt it brush against him. Where it went, he did not know. He was thinking too much of the children to look. The surprise and relief, the children were not at all frightened. On the contrary, they were laughing. "Is the funny dog yours, Daddy?" one of them, a little girl, asked. "It never wagged its tail like other doggies do, and whenever we tried to stroke it, it slipped away from us." Mr. McKay pretended that it was a dog belonging to a neighbor. He told his wife what had occurred, and she declared that they must leave the house as soon as possible. He agreed. That night, he sat in his study writing, long after everyone had gone to bed. It was nearly 1 o'clock when he rose from his chair. He was about to turn off the gas when he felt his outstretched hand seized by something cold and pulpy that did not seem to have any fingers. He was so terrified that he screamed, whereupon his hand was instantly released, and there was a loud crash overhead. He rushed to his wife's room and found her sitting up in bed, talking in her sleep. She appeared to be speaking to a dark, shadowy figure that was crouching on the floor by the bed. It resembled the shadow that he had seen on the wall the day on which he had come to view the house. It was not a dog, not a wolf, not a bear, but a grotesque mixture of all three, combined with something human and very evil. It vanished almost at once. Mrs. McKay woke and said that she had had a very horrible dream. She dreamed that she had witnessed a very dreadful murder committed in the house by a person who did not look human. She declared that the house was haunted by something extremely evil and begged her husband to vacate it that very day. She said that nothing would persuade her to stay another night in it. Within 24 hours, the house was once again vacant. Mr. McKay made numerous inquiries about the house, but elicited no information other than that it had long been rumored to be haunted, and no tenant ever stayed in it for long. A strange story of a spirit prognosticating death was told in the Christmas number of the Weekly Scotsman. An acquaintance of the writer, the story went on a visit one Christmas to a house in Perth. He intended to spend a week there. On the night of his arrival, being very tired, he went to bed early and was soon sound asleep. He awoke with a violent start to find himself lying on his back, staring up at the moonlit ceiling with wide open eyes. One of his hands was hanging over the side of the bed. Suddenly it was gripped by an icy cold hand which lacked a middle finger. The shock was so great that he nearly fainted, but recovering with an effort, he leaned over the side of the bed and with his left hand felt the icy hand and arm that was holding his right hand. The arm terminated at the elbow. The shock of this discovery proved too great. He really did faint this time. When he recovered consciousness, his right hand was free. The cold phantom hand had gone. At breakfast in the morning, he related his experience to his host, who, on hearing the description of the hand, turned deathly pale and said, "For goodness sake, say no more. Years ago, an ancestor of mine, who had lost the middle finger of his right hand under anything but credible circumstances, committed suicide in your room, and ever since then he has periodically haunted the room. His presence never presages a serious happening unless he catches hold of anyone. Should he do that, some terrible misfortune is sure to occur." He had hardly finished speaking when a maid entered the room and handed him a telegram. It stated that his youngest son had died suddenly. The House of the Crazy Fancies. During a period of over 40 years, I have given talks on ghostly phenomena to all kinds of audiences and in all kinds of places, and after my talks, people have told me some of their own experiences with the supernatural. The story of the House of Crazy Fancies was told me by a lady after a talk by me at a well-known Mayfair club. She said that she was intimately acquainted with the family mentioned in the story. The story, which is compiled from the notes that I made at the time that it was related to me, runs thus. The house was somewhere in Surrey, not many miles from London. It was not very old, and there was nothing remarkable in its appearance, nothing to suggest even to an impressionable, highly sensitive person that it was haunted. People passed it without so much as a glance at it. It was just a very ordinary-looking, detached villa in a quiet road in a town within 20 miles of London. It had stood empty for some time before Ronald Gregory Walker, pleased with the account Mabel, his pretty blonde wife, gave of it, after going over it one day with an estate agent's clerk, bought it and had the good luck to move when the weather was fine. Moving in wet weather does furniture no good and makes cleaning extra hard. The Walker family consisted of Ronald, a middle-aged, thoroughly practical, hard-headed businessman, Mabel, his junior by 10 years, Peter's eldest son was a medical student, Violet, 19 years of age, blonde and pretty, like her mother, Roma, still at school, not as fair as Violet, but nonetheless attractive, and Jack, age 12, and at a local preparatory school. The house had in the rear of it quite a large garden, which from long lack of attention was overgrown with weeds. Ronald promised the boys a good tip apiece if they would help the gardener get it in order. He was fond of gardening and he believed in making his sons useful at home. It was in this garden, there was a smaller front garden, that the first of the queer happenings that were later destined to drive them out of the house took place. Peter and Jack had been helping Smith the gardener during the afternoon with the flower beds and after he had his tea and gum, they were having a little game with a tennis ball. Roma came out of the house to call the men to tea. The bell had been rung more than once. Picking up the ball which Jack had thrown to her, but which she declared she would not catch owing to the waning daylight, she threw it at a cat that had raised her ire by killing birds. The ball, going wide of its mark, a common occurrence with her, entered a nearby bush and was at once returned to her with considerable force. Greatly astounded, she called out, "Who's that? What are you doing there?" She ran to the bush and looked behind it. No one was there. "What's up?" Peter asked. Roma told him, and he and Jack searched around without finding anyone. The bush was well away from the walls surrounding the garden. They were high walls, and it would have been practically impossible for anyone to have scaled one of them without being seen. There was a door leading into a lane at the end of the garden, but it was locked and bolted. Neither of the boys could have thrown the ball because they were not near enough to the bush at the time. Trivial as was the incident, it greatly perplexed and mystified Roma and her brothers. Roma told her parents, who laughed and said that someone must have been hiding in the garden and thrown the ball for fun. Roma and the boys declared that this was impossible since they had searched the garden so thoroughly and there was really nowhere for anyone to have hidden. Ronald and Mabel shrugged. "Someone was there," they persisted. "It was dusk and you didn't see them." The trio let it go at that, but they weren't satisfied. Some nights after the incident of the ball, Ronald Walker was sitting in the little room which he called his study. By him on the table were several sealed and addressed envelopes. He had been striving to work off much overdue arrears in correspondence, and becoming weary had lain down his pen to rest a while. It was close on midnight. The rest of the household had long gone to bed. The house and everywhere was still. Not a sound except the pattering of raindrops in the window pane. The weather being cold and wet, he had drawn the heavy green curtains across the window recess. Now something made him look at them. They were violently shaking. Thinking this odd, he rose from his seat and, going to the window, made sure that it was shut and latched. He felt with his hand to see if there was much draught. There was a little, but assuredly not enough to produce such shaking in the curtains. A little puzzled, he returned to his seat and drew it nearer to the gas fire. He felt suddenly chilly. Perhaps it was the behavior of the curtains, and his mind reverted to Roma's story of the tennis ball. Of course, someone had been hiding in the bush and had thrown it at her. Probably a boy from one of the neighboring houses. He had seen boys going in and out of several of the houses in the road. The young devil had no doubt enjoyed their inability to find him and had made off as soon as the coast was clear. What more likely? The silence was very profound. It rather got on his nerves. He wanted to go to bed, but the warmth of the fire was so enjoyable that he did not like leaving it. A sudden consciousness of some presence behind him made him glance apprehensively round. There was no one. He frowned at the wallpaper, a vile mixture of bilious yellow and dyspeptic green, with a jumble of flowers of an unknown species. It was soiled and had probably been on the walls for many years. The longer he stared at it, the more it jarred his nerves. He determined to get rid of it as soon as possible. There seemed to be something unusual about it tonight, something that made him keep on gazing at it, at one spot in particular. Of course, it was just his silly imagination, but in the flowers and leaves he could see a grotesque resemblance to a face, such as one sometimes sees in a fire or in the pattern of a carpet. It became more and more pronounced. A queer, distorted face with prick ears, a grinning mouth, and ogreish, leering eyes. With an effort, he tore his gaze from it, but wherever he looked, it was the same. Grotesque faces grinned and leered mockingly at him. He rubbed his eyes, but still he saw them. "I've been using my brain too much," he thought to himself. "I'm suffering from hallucination. Perhaps I ate more than was good for me, or it may be eye strain." Whatever the faces were, figments of his distorted imagination, or actually in the design on the walls, they were harassing, and he did not like them. At last, unable to bear the sight of them any longer, he got up, left the room, and went to bed. As soon as he came down in the morning, he went to the study and looked at the wallpaper. There were the flowers and intertwining nondescript leaves, but no suggestion of the queer faces. Consequently, he tried to persuade himself that they were entirely imaginary. He did not say a word about them to the family. It was Mabel Walker's turn next. One evening, about a week after Ronald's experience in the study, she was sitting in the drawing room, mending socks and stockings. Ronald was at a club dinner. Peter and Jack were spending the week with friends in the country, and the two girls were at a party. Mabel was alone in the house and felt like it. Everywhere was so very quiet, and there was such a sense of no one but herself in the building. Suddenly, she had a feeling of being watched. It was distinctly disquieting. She did not like it. She got up and made sure the curtains were drawn and that no one could see in through the window. She went into the hall and into the rooms and kitchen and tried the front and back doors to see if they were fastened. In fact, so strong had been the impression of eyes covertly spying her that she searched everywhere. Convinced at last that no one but herself was in the house, she returned to her comfortable seat by the fire. As soon as she had finished mending one pair of socks or stockings, she put them on the Chesterfield, which was close at hand. She was in the act of putting a pair there when she stopped short. There were four cushions on the Chesterfield, two at each end, and the one on which her eyes were riveted bore a not at all nice resemblance to a face. There was a protuberance for the nose, another protuberance for a sharply defined chin, a long dent for a mouth, and two small dents for the eyes, which were unpleasantly lifelike and seemed to be regarding her with an expression of malicious amusement. She looked at the other cushions, and in each one of them she saw a different face, equally if not more sinister and mocking. Fearing there was either something wrong with her brain or stomach, she got up and, having rearranged the cushions, went on with her mending, swearing at the manufacturers for making such very poor material, at the shops where they came from for charging such exorbitant prices, and at the government for allowing such gross profiteering. Presently, she was again conscious of being watched, and on looking round, she saw with a start that the cushions were not as she had left them. There were again faces, queer animal faces, with the same expression of malicious amusement in their eyes. She became scared and wondered if she was in a nightmare. To make sure that she was awake, she rose and looked at herself in the mirror over the mantel shelf. When she got back to her chair, the faces were no longer to be seen. The front doorbell rang. She went to the door and asked who was there. There was no reply. She opened the door. No one was there. She was about to return to the drawing room when something caused her to look at the coats hanging in the hall. It was then that she got her second start. This time it was a very big one, for one of the coats, a long white mackintosh, was not hanging loosely down like the other coats, but was bulging in a very peculiar manner. It seemed very much as if some strange thing of an alarming shape and of considerable size was inside it. It gave her a distinctly uncanny sensation. Endeavoring to be calm, she was about to cross to the mackintosh to find out what was causing the bulge when there were three sharp knocks on the front door. It was Ronald. After listening to his account of the dinner, she told him that she believed she must be going mad or else there was something very much the matter with her eyes. When he asked what made her think such a thing, she told him about the mackintosh and cushions. He listened with interest to all she had to say and then said, "Well, if you are mad, I must be mad too." And he proceeded to tell her about the faces in the wallpaper. They agreed not to say anything about their experiences at present to the children. When they had done talking, Mabel suddenly remembered the mackintosh. They went together to the recess. The mackintosh no longer bulged. It was hanging quite normally. That there was something very queer about the house, they were now constrained to admit. Before coming there, they had rather scoffed at the idea of a supernatural, but after what they had experienced, they did not feel like scoffing anymore. Nearly a fortnight passed without anything further happening, and they were beginning to feel that the haunting, if such it could be termed, had really ceased when something occurred to shatter their optimism. This time Violet was the victim. She slept in a room in the front of the house. Roma was in the next room, which was really a dressing room leading into the larger room where her mother slept. She had gone to bed rather earlier than usual one night and had fallen asleep almost as soon as her head rested on the pillow. She awoke to hear almost immediately a loud creaking near, so it seemed, the bed. Just the furniture, probably due to a change in the temperature, she thought. Yet she wondered why she never seemed to hear furniture creaking in the daytime. Changes in the temperature surely took place during the day. Then why not creakings? Presently, there were more of them. The boards creaked. There was a very loud creak seemingly in the big hanging wardrobe and another in a chair close beside the bed. It really sounded as if someone was sitting on the chair. The sounds irritated and worried her to such a degree that she got up, lit a candle, and looked everywhere to see if Jinx, the black cat, was in the room. He sometimes sneaked into one of the rooms during the evening and hid in a cupboard or under the bed. Jinx was not in the room. She was about to blow out the light and get back into bed when the bed rose as if someone was under it. Opening the door very quietly, so as to be able to escape quickly should anyone suddenly pop out, she got her hockey stick and poked about with it none too gently under the bed. It met with no resistance. Kneeling down, she peered under the bed, and to her relief, no one was there. Thinking that she must have been suffering from some kind of illusion, she got up and was once again about to blow out the light when what she now saw caused her to pause aghast. The bedclothes were not as she had left them. Neither was the pillow nor the bolster. The bedclothes were arranged in such a fashion that it looked very much as if someone was in the bed. There were the distinct outlines of a long body, legs, and torso. The pillow, no longer flat, formed the head, with a white face turned towards her. The features, the hooked nose, the gaping mouth, and the deep-set eyes, all clearly outlined, were not lifelike, because the whole body, in fact, gave Violet the impression of a much too realistic and woefully evil corpse. Telling herself that it was very silly to be frightened by a pillow and bedclothes, but nevertheless continuing to be frightened, she could not forget seeing the bed rise. She got into bed with the candle still burning, and after a while fell asleep and did not wake until the morning. Contrary to her expectation, no one laughed when she narrated her experience at the breakfast table. They all listened gravely. "I had much the same experience 2 nights ago," Peter said. "I wasn't going to say anything about it, but after what you have told us, I won't keep it to myself any longer." His story was as follows. Not feeling well, he got up in the night, and having lighted the gas fire, as he felt chilly, he went to the laboratory, where he was sick. On coming back to his room, he was startled to see a figure sitting in the armchair near the window. "Who the devil are you?" he exclaimed. There was no reply. The figure remained perfectly still. He spoke again, and more peremptorily, still no answer. Wondering who the person could be, he advanced a few paces nearer to the chair. The window slightly open, and the night wind blew into the room with a gust, stirring the curtains and causing them to rustle with a ghostly sound. The figure in the chair was alarmingly queer. Its head went up into a grotesque peak. It had pointed ears and no apparent neck. In the glow from the fire, the face of the figure in the chair shone in unearthly white. There was something so bizarre about it that he was scared, although he tried to assure himself that it could only be an illusion. He lit the candle, and when he looked at the chair, the strange figure had vanished. Only his coat and trousers were on the chair. He had put them on before getting into bed. He spent quite a long time endeavoring to arrange them to resemble the figure that he had seen, but try how he would, he could not succeed. They kept on being just his clothes, bearing no likeness whatsoever to the frightening figure. Other queer things happened. The walkers continually lost things, to find them afterwards either in a place which they had thoroughly searched, or in a spot where it did not seem possible that they could have put them. The house finally got on all of their nerves to such an extent that they were obliged to leave it long before the expiration of the lease. Neither their servants nor their visitors ever complained of any queer happenings in the house, and the people who occupied the house after the walkers had left it lived there seemingly perfectly peacefully and were never known to complain of being harassed in any way. The walkers wondered if they had been affected by the lingering thoughts of some former occupant of the house who had been at all deranged, whether there was something really supernatural in the house that, for a very peculiar reason, was inimical only to them. The ball incident in the garden seemed to give considerable color to this supposition.